Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Music from a NASA simulation of a stellar collision called a kilonova. Scientists worldwide were gaga over this recent discovery, calling it a massive human achievement, one that would unlock the secrets of the universe and begin a whole new field of astronomy. Today in The Exchange, our own New Hampshire-based space crew is back, and we'll ask them why this kilonova has astronomers so excited. Join us with your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The members of our crew, Mal Cameron, former educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. Mal, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. John, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Nicole Gallucci, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at St. Anselm College. Nicole's Twitter handle is Noisy Astronomer. And Nicole, welcome back. Good to see you,
Thanks. Good to be here.
So we also have that NASA video of the simulated kilonova up on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Check it out. There's a lot of other resources there, cool pictures and videos of space. So lots on the web. And in our discussion, folks, we really should jump into this kilonova first. But I don't even really know where to start, Nicole. I mean, there's so much to unpack here. So just how do we even begin to start looking at this story? It's so huge.
Yeah, it's a big story. It involved a whole lot of people in this discovery and the follow-up. But I think one of the key features is the fact that this involves direct detection of gravitational waves. So the Nobel Prize in Physics just went for that first detection. This was not the first detection, but this is the first time we've detected gravitational waves from a source and seen it at the same time in light, so in different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. So that's pretty spectacular, is that we can use those two methods now. They call it multi-messenger astronomy, using multiple ways of viewing an event with gravitational waves and with light to really get down to the heart and the physics of it.
So this is the first time we've heard it and seen it.
That's one way, yeah, that's a good way of thinking of it.
And what is it, Nicole? I mean, gravitational waves and then a kilonova. I'm not even really sure what these things are.
So basically what happened is 130 million years ago in a galaxy not super far away, these two neutron stars collided. And it's taken 130 million years to reach us here on Earth. And it was detected on August 17th in gravitational waves. So the observatory that did this detection is called LIGO. It's the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. It's, if you can imagine, this very large L-shaped detector with lasers going down the end of it. And they time exactly how long it takes the laser to bounce along these long tubes, these long tunnels. And when a gravitational wave comes by, it's actually distorting space-time. So it's distorting the fabric of space and time, the universe, stuff that we're made of. And they can detect that by using the slight change in timing of those lasers down those tubes. Now, of course, they have to separate that out from other sources like a truck driving by or, you know, micro earthquakes. So they detect this with several detectors in the U.S. And then there's also a detector in Europe that picked this up as well. What was super cool about this one is the they call it the chirp. The previous ones from black hole collisions were very short. This one lasted for like 100 seconds, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for this type of signal, it's a lot, which meant that there was something different going on. It wasn't two black holes colliding. Maybe it's something smaller, two neutron stars.
So, John, picking up on what Nicole said about this collision happened, what did you say, Nicole, 130 million years ago? So is this why, John, astronomers have been saying this actually gives us a chance to peer back into time?
Well, astronomers have been doing that a long time. And in fact, we do it every day, right? Because space is so big and light travels at a fixed speed. It travels at 186,000 miles every second. So the farther away you look in space, the longer ago in time you're seeing. For example, the sun is about 93 million miles away from the Earth. And when you look up at the sun, and I wouldn't recommend anybody doing this for extended periods of time, but you're not seeing the sun the way it looked at that exact instant. You're looking at the sun the way it was 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago. If you look at a star like Vega, a bright star that's a little bit past directly overhead when it gets dark in the fall, that's about 26 light years away. So you're looking at Vega on October 27th, because it's going to be cloudy tonight and tomorrow. You're seeing the Vega not the way it looked on October 27th, 2017. You're looking at it the way it looked 26 years ago, because that's how long the light took to get to us. So when we talk about something that's in another galaxy altogether, and they're very, very far away, so you're looking at an event that took place that many years ago. So space is big, light travels at a fixed rate, and it takes time, even for light, to traverse these huge distances. So the amazing thing about the event that happened on the 17th, as Nicole said, unlike the previous detection of gravitational waves, which before last year had never been detected before, this one was the merger two neutron stars, which is basically a star that doesn't produce energy anymore, that's more massive than the sun. It doesn't produce any energy through the fusion process, which powers most stars. And these are very massive, and they were used to be a double star system, two stars orbiting a common center of gravity. And what happens, in this case at least, the neutron stars were spiraling closer and closer and closer together at a more and more rapid speed, and they finally merged. And when that happened, gravitational waves were produced, but the difference was that the neutron star, its gravity isn't so strong as to prevent light from escaping from that explosion. And so it was able to be seen at different wavelengths of radiation. So that's what the big buzz is.
Well, there's been so much buzz about so many aspects of this, and it's still hard for us to wrap our heads around the idea that you can look back in time. Another thing that people were excited about, Mal Cameron, was the heavy metals that were released from this, gold, platinum, uranium, and others. Somebody said that, you know, imagine all the, you know, from the wedding band on your hand to, sure, you know, all the pharaoh's treasures. I mean, all that came from these types of events. Where does all that stuff go now? Or has it already gone somewhere? I guess it was 130 million years ago, so maybe the dust has already been swept up, so to speak.
It gets scattered into space.
Yeah.
That's how we have all these heavy items here on the Earth, is because of the way our solar system was formed about a little over 4.5 billion years ago. And it was an explosion of a star that went supernova and collapsed and exploded and sent the materials flying through space. And when they go at that speed, they bump into each other and start creating these heavier elements. So all the things we find on Earth can be traced back to that explosion. In the case of this detection, the neutron stars are different. As we were, if I can go back, one thing I wanted to go back to is that to assure everybody that when we're talking about a kilonova, we're not talking about a killer nova.
Yes, it's kilo.
It's K-I-L-O. Killa, K-I-L-O.
Right.
It's just a name for this type of explosion. And we're talking about ripples. The easiest way to picture that is if you put your finger in the water, if you're cruising down with your canoe or something, or any boats that go out on a lake, they create a wake around them that spreads out from where they're traveling. If you think about throwing a rock or dropping a rock in water, you get that series of concentric circles that spread out. That's how this works. And when it's spinning in the process, it makes a spiral shape to it. And they're not easy to detect. The reason we're able to get them now is because we've now created instruments that are sensitive enough to detect it. What they're detecting is the changes at a scale of about 1/1000th the width of a proton.
That sounds quite tiny.
Very tiny.
It's hard to sort of figure out this scale of these events. I mean, you talked about something that's so tiny, and yet this collision, explosion was so massive. Again, NASA has some great simulations to help you kind of visualize what might be going on here. And you can check them out on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. If you heard news recently about this kilonova, not killer nova. Thank you, Mal, for that. Kilonova. Join us with your comments, questions, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. A couple more questions, folks, on this kilonova. And then I do want to turn to a possible new moon mission between the U.S. and the Russians. Also speculation about a so-called Planet Nine, mystery there in our solar system. But a couple more questions on this kilonova. So, Nicole, you alluded to this. One of the things that was a big headline out of this was just that literally thousands of astronomers worked on this together. It's kind of heartening, actually, to see scientists from all over the world coming together on this. Just explain how that happened, please.
Sure. So someone made the estimate that something like 15% of the world's astronomers were involved in this discovery.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
I can corroborate my I get the press releases from different observatories. When there's a news story, and a big news story, might get two or three observatories involved. That morning that this came out, on the 16th, I got 28 different press releases about this story from different astronomy departments, observatories who had all been a part of it. So it's huge in that way. What happened is LIGO made this detection. It was followed up by Virgo, which is a similar gravitational wave detector in Europe. And those two positions meant that they could hone in on what direction in the sky it came from. Now, the position they got was actually a very large patch of sky. It was 50 square degrees. It's like 250 times the area of the moon. So this is actually huge for astronomers. But they also made a detection with a gamma ray burst monitor on NASA's Fermi gamma ray telescope. So that was the first indication that we're getting light, not just gravitational waves from this thing. So this gamma ray burst detector picked it up. And the news went out to all these different observatories, and a whole bunch of observatories jumped on to look for this. X-ray telescopes in space, optical telescopes on the ground, infrared telescopes. And it was several hours into it that the SWOPE telescope, which is one I didn't know before, it's a collection of optical telescopes in Chile, were the first ones to pick it up. They had to search through...
Pick up the light.
Yeah, pick up the signal, the visible and infrared light. They had to search through 50 different galaxies to find this thing within a few hours. So they figured it out. It was a galaxy called NGC 4993, typical telephone number type name. And they followed it up for several days in optical and infrared. And then it wasn't until over a week later they saw the X-rays, and then 2 weeks after the merger they saw radio waves. So we're still getting signals from different processes happening. There's the initial merger itself, there's the fusion of the elements that it creates, and then what's left over from the explosion is still interacting with something called the interstellar medium, the gas and dust and stuff that surrounded what once was these two neutron stars. So in fact, the Very Large Array, one of my favorite telescopes, it's in New Mexico, it's a Y-shaped array of radio antennas, made that first radio detection, and the radio waves, that's the only ground-based telescope that can still detect it. The optical light has faded, but they can still see the radio light. So all of these telescopes jumped on and were able to help astronomers do this analysis. One fun part of the story that I like, I don't know how many of you guys listening are familiar with Slack. It's a chat app. A lot of people use it for business and projects, but it's on your phone, it's on your computer. And so screenshots of the Slack chat of these very excited astronomers. You're like, oh my God, there's a thing. I'm quickly going to bike over in the dark, you know, stuff like that, to getting to their telescopes to actually see this thing go.
Well, that was exciting. And as you said earlier, Nicole, you know, at first people heard it, and then all of those who had the ability to hear, which wasn't very many installations, from what I understand, said to the people who can see it, quick, go look for this thing visually. And they were excited. And one of the sentences that I keep hearing, John, from this is this event, if I could call it that, has sparked a whole new field of astronomy. Now, that sounds ginormous. I mean, how is this a whole new field of astronomy? How so?
Well, the detection of gravitational waves revolutionized looking at events in the universe that are very big in scale. The fact that we can now detect gravitational waves with one set of instruments and then find the optical or the visual, if you will, or the radiation counterpart, the source of the gravitational waves, that's the first time that's ever happened. And whenever you can observe an object in more than one wavelength, more than one color of light, if you will, really informs you about the event, the conditions of the event, and in this case, gravitational waves. That's just adds to the huge success of now our ability to detect these events. So that's what's the big deal. It's looking at events on such a grand scale in more than one wavelength. And you have to understand that the institutions, the observatories and the institutions involved in this stopped what they were doing and picked this hunt up to look for this. And, you know, scientists and astronomers alike, they collaborate all the time. There's nothing new. But this is huge in scale. Like Nicole said, you know, two or three observatories collaborate routinely on stories and events and discoveries, but to get 4,000 plus astronomers in many, many different institutions working across different wavelengths, that's a great show of community, and it's a great way for humans to learn stuff and get it out to people.
Well, here's a great question that just came in from Russell. He sent us an email, and you can send us an email as well, by the way, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So here's Russell's email. He says, without sounding too ignorant, how do they know these waves they're detecting are from this kilonova or whatever it is and not picking up something from something else? And Russell, it's a reasonable question. Mal, what do you think?
Well, Nicole kind of—
There's a lot of space noise out there.
Sure. You have to know what, like she was saying earlier about trucks going by could shake the ground and affect the laser beam and that sort of thing. But the sensitivity is you have to know where that's coming from and how fast it's coming, I suppose. But I was asking the same question, Russell. I was thinking, how do they know what area of the sky this came from? And I'm sure it's not that precise, because as we were saying, we had a large area of the sky where we said, it's in there somewhere. But what happens is the sensitivity is such so that they know the type of fluctuation they're looking for. And that's going to actually get better because, as we were saying, there's one in Italy they call Virgo that backed up, and we could triangulate from there to the area of the sky. There's actually a fourth one in the works that India is going to be building one as well down the road a little bit. So that could make this type of astronomy even more refined.
So there's redundancy in this detection system. There's a couple different people in different parts of the world listening and then looking for this. Russell, thank you for the email. You can email us as well. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, a story that caught my eye, folks. The U.S. and Russia collaborate on a mission to the moon. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey, Virginia Prescott.
Hey, Nick Capodice.
Give me the first U.S. president born in a hospital.
James Buchanan.
James Buchanan?
It's light.
Wasn't he our singlest president?
It's Jimmy Carter.
Seriously?
Seriously.
If you want to top that, come to NHPR's first ever Civics 101 Bar Trivia Night at True Brew Barista in Concord on Wednesday, October 25th at 7.
Virginia and I are hosting it. It'll be so fun. More info at nhpr.org.
So come on. You couldn't sound any stupider than I just did.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our New Hampshire-based space crew is back explaining some blockbuster events in astronomy this fall, including a stellar collision called a kilonova. We've been talking about that, and we welcome your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Other headlines that we're going to talk about, American and Russian collaboration on a mission to the moon, not just to visit, but to stick around for a while. We'd love your thoughts on that as well. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So Mal, John, and Nicole, let's talk about that mission to the moon. It's a little different from those missions that many people know from the 60s and 70s. Here's Vice President Mike Pence speaking earlier this month about the Trump administration's space goals.
We will return American astronauts to the moon, not only to leave behind footprints and flags, but to build the foundation we need to send Americans to Mars and beyond.
Again, that's Vice President Mike Pence speaking earlier this month. So, Mal Cameron, what's this new mission all about? Do we know?
Well, in September, just a little over a month ago, the U.S. signed an agreement with Russia to build a space station eventually to orbit the moon. And the concept, there's always been this concept of having something already in space, like a gas station in space, if you will, to get refueled or to build something large in space, so it would ultimately save money and so on. But here, it's a similar idea. If we have a space station of sorts around the moon with supplies on it, we could send a spacecraft there, and they could prep from there for a trip to Mars, for example. The other concept is to have eventually some sort of habitats on the moon itself so that people could go there and live for a while and do experiments and whatever.
What's the benefit, Mal, of having a spacecraft that's orbiting the moon versus having it on the moon? Seems like it'd be easier to be, you know, parked on the surface.
If you're already in space orbiting the moon, all you have to do is dock with it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to land on the moon and then return, you need fuel and you need a little more technology to get you onto the surface safely and also back into space again.
So it's a spaceport in orbit.
Right. The program's called the Deep Space Gateway.
Gateway meaning
to,
on to Mars.
Where do you want to go today?
Where else? Although, again, and others jump in too, please. You know, maybe you, John. It's hard for me to understand how having something on the moon helps us get to Mars. The moon, from what I understand, is only 3 days away. Mars is 9 months away. So, you know, why bother with that little, you know, side stop?
Well,
it's like you're on a road trip and, you know, 10 minutes in the car, one of your kids says, I'm hungry. You know, just go.
Well, let's take something that Mal said a minute ago, a gas station. So recently, over the last 10 years, it's still safe to say 10 years, we now know that there's water ice on the moon. And in some instances, we're learning that the moon is wetter. That is, doesn't have liquid water on it, and there's not a lot of ice, but there's more water content in the moon beneath the surface than we first thought. So if you look at what water is, it's a molecule that contains both oxygen and hydrogen, and that's what we use for rocket fuel. So let's say that not in the initial days of this orbiting moon station, but eventually it could be possible to mine raw materials from the surface of the moon, convert that to rocket fuel, and use that to fuel long missions into interplanetary space rather than lifting all that heavy fuel off of the Earth, which has a much stronger gravity than the moon does. It takes much less energy to reach lunar orbit and break free of the lunar gravity than it does to take to break free of the Earth's gravity.
That is a really good point, and I had not thought of that.
So the moon could be, not because it's closer to Mars, because it's only 387,000 kilometers from Earth. It's like you said, 10 minutes you have to go to the bathroom in a trip, right? But it's a place where we could really embark from. Maybe we could assemble the crew in Earth orbit and send it to the orbiting lunar depot, pick up the fuel, and who knows, maybe we build stuff in lunar orbit. I don't know. But that's in the more little bit more remote future, maybe 10 years or something like that. But initially, it's a step in the right direction. And to be honest, any kind of cooperation internationally in space is good for the world. All the problems we have with Russia, it certainly, science is a great area to collaborate on, work together, and illustrate and prove to each other that we have more similarities than we have differences. And I know that's kind of pie in the sky-ish, but if we don't start somewhere, there's not going to be a mission to Mars in 20 or 30 years if we keep behaving the way we do.
Well, and there's a long history of working with the Russians, Nicole, right? I mean, I think the Russians have the only bus up to the International Space Station now.
That's right, so, yeah. Those good old Soyuz still going are what we take to put humans on the International Space Station. And I think that's a really important point. We have to remember the sociology and even the politics of doing something like going to Mars. It's different from a road trip in that you have to take all your own air and food and civilization with you. So learning how to live in space, learning how to live in a lower gravity environment, learning how to live in a closed environment, that's something that's best done closer to home, where you can come home if there's an emergency. From the International Space Station to the moon, which is 3 days away, it's good preparation and training for us as a species to figure out how to go to Mars.
What do you think about this lunar spaceport? Again, Mal described it as this, a spaceport going around the moon. How useful would that be, Nicole?
I think you hit it on the head with it's more useful to be in orbit than on the ground, because you have to take fuel to get out of a gravitational well, to get off the ground, even if something as small as the moon. So having that spaceport makes it a bit easier. Yeah.
All right.
If I may, there is a thing you call escape velocity. You need so much velocity to get off of the surface of anything, even the moon. And so when you're already in space, you don't have to use as much fuel. I think we covered that. In this case, even though they signed an agreement to build this, it's not going to be right away. They probably won't start until another decade down the road. So it's just something they're working on in the meantime.
Let's take a call. And Steve is in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Mel.
Good morning, Steve.
I've been obsessed with going to the moon ever since we landed there, and I thought that was one of the greatest achievements of the lifetime of the Earth, where we left the Earth. So I have been reading in National Geographic that there's a competition, a private competition between different companies, I know one from India, one from Israel, racing to the moon to put something on the moon. And I think it's a fascinating fact. I mean, I love the fact we're going back to the moon anyways. So that's what I want to ask you about.
So, and Steve, sounds like Steve is waiting for his ticket to go. And I do wonder, anybody know? I mean, are there private companies saying,
yes,
give us $25,000 and we'll take you to the moon? I mean,
well, it's John? Space tourism is going to happen. I just read an article that said Bigelow Aerospace and United Launch Alliance are sending an inflatable habitat to the moon in 2022. Now, the whole notion of inflatable habitats is the hotel industry in space, whether it's low Earth orbit or orbiting the moon. So I'll ask you, Laura, how much would you pay for you and your family to take a 2-week vacation in a hotel that orbits the moon? I can guarantee a round trip, and the views will be spectacular. I don't know about the food yet, but this is a reality. And it may not be a reality in 2017, but here companies are going on the record in October of 2017 saying this is what we're doing in 2022.
Wow, that's amazing. That's not that far away.
Once those floodgates are opened, that's going to be, it's going to duplicate the tourism industry all over the planet.
Okay, well, now, I personally wouldn't pay anything because I don't like to be cooped up. But but go ahead, Nicole. I love your thoughts, too.
I think the competition he's talking about is the Google Lunar X Prize. And I actually was fortunate to interview the Israel team for a YouTube show that I used to do. They have certain goals that they have to have a spacecraft, you know, get to the moon, land on the moon, and then like pick itself up and move. Oh, not necessarily pick itself. Move, send back images and move across the surface.
Yeah, like 500 feet or something. They have to. It's a minimum distance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are different groups that are working on building that technology and different ways of attacking that problem for that X Prize. So it's pretty exciting to see different companies from different nations working towards that.
So there are project teams at the University of New Hampshire that work on space projects and competitions like this every year. There's juniors and seniors working on developing a craft that can move across the Martian or the lunar surface and pick up things and communicate back, even bring things back to Earth. So this is a kind of a pervasive, maybe not too well known about endeavor that many people, students and people all over the world, are participating in.
Wow. Well, 5 years, Stephen Nottingham, not too far away, but who knows how much those tickets might be. Let's take another call, folks. And Zach is joining us from Barrington. Hi, Zach. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi there. So I have a question for both of you. If we're going to be using the moon and things, Mars to mine resources, how are you going to control that? Is that going to be a privatized thing? Is it going to be government controlled? Is there any sort of idea of what regulatory standards would be put in place once we start pulling things out of other planets?
You know, Zach, this is a great question. And it gets to a theme that we have talked about over the years on this program. And that's, you know, it used to be sort of NASA and the Russians were the only game in town. Then it was NASA and the Russians and the Chinese and the Europeans. Now the Indians are getting involved in the game. And Mal, all these private companies too. I mean, Elon Musk and SpaceX, and Nicole mentioned the Google project and so forth. So it's a great question, Zach. A lot of people getting involved.
Yeah, if I could just speculate, I think you're going to see a melding of privatized as well as government, like NASA, things working together. In fact, NASA is working with places like Elon Musk and his SpaceX. SpaceX is now launching from one of NASA's prime launch pads at Kennedy Space Center, where all the Apollo missions took place.
So there's collaboration in these private and public entities.
Right. And there's a lot of competition between the privatized because ultimately the hope is they can do it cheaper. And so far they've been proving that. SpaceX, of course, has had the spacecraft that they can return to space, reuse the whole part of their rocket. Their Falcon 9 will land now, and they're getting to control that much better. I think you're going to see them taking off along with others like Orbital. There's a group called Orbital that's going to be bringing just a couple of weeks from now. They're supposed to launch to the space station again, too. So there's this collaboration between the two sides all the time.
But Zach's point is well taken. You know, lots of entities, lots of different people and groups. And so he seems to be saying you got to have some sort of set of standards so that the astronauts aren't stranded.
And the insurance companies are busy. So that's why I talk to business students who take astronomy classes at UNH. It's great to have them because when they graduate, this will be an option for them because we need people to be cognizant of the risks and the laws that govern who can do what on an interplanetary body. Who's to say that, you know, some private company couldn't go to the moon and start, you know, prospecting for water ice to turn into rocket fuel. That's a huge undertaking.
Well, and we have an email exactly to that effect. Here's an email from Ella who says, "Is nothing sacrosanct? Mining the moon." She says, "Don't. We already live in a closed system we are destroying." So what do you think about this whole conversation, Nicole?
So I actually have a student this semester who's working on a paper for an honors project, which is fascinating, especially if you're a sci-fi dork like I am, which is comparing the world of Frank Herbert's Dune. So if you're familiar with it, they mine this spice. It has all these weird magical properties. It's a fabulous story. But he's comparing that sociopolitical structure to the one that we have now and talking about, it's 20,000 years in the future this book is set, right? So it's super far. But he's looking into what international treaties do we have about space now? As far as I can tell, it seems like there's been treaties about what nation states can do in space, but there hasn't been a lot said about what private companies
can do
in space.
Exactly. That's the big question.
Yeah. I also love having our politics and business majors in our astronomy class because they bring that perspective.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I had not thought about that, but it's an important cross-disciplinary thought approach. You know, speaking of private companies really getting involved in the game, of course, we should talk a little bit more about Elon Musk's plans. Here he is at the International Astronautical Conference in late September. This is in Australia, where Elon Musk describes why he's so focused on humanity becoming what he calls a multi-planetary species.
The future is vastly more exciting and interesting if we're a spacefaring civilization and a multi-planet species than if we're not. You want to be inspired by things. You want to wake up in the morning and think the future is going to be great. And that's what being a spacefaring civilization is all about. It's about believing in the future and thinking that the future will be better than the past. And I can't think of anything more exciting than going out there and being among the stars.
Again, that's Elon Musk speaking recently at a conference in Australia about the human beings becoming a multiplanetary species. So, John, to you, but anybody jump in, please. One of the things that Elon Musk talked about when he was at this conference was what he calls his BFR, a big rocket, basically. He's got big plans for this rocket, not just going to Mars eventually by 2022, which is, let's just say, 5 years away, but also going city to city. He had this big presentation about, you know, London to Sydney, half an hour, New York to Singapore, half an hour. So using this rocket, not just to get up to Mars, but go, you know, to London for lunch.
Well, I'm not sure how practical that is, but the fact of what Musk is saying about exploring space is getting a huge dialogue going. I mean, we're talking about him. He's giving talks in Australia. The expansion of space and his point, and the point maybe that he didn't elaborate on that short clip, was that eventually it might be beneficial to the human species to occupy more than one planet. But that's not the end-all answer to everything, right? And as Ella pointed out, you know, we're not doing that good a job taking care of the Earth. Maybe we're doing a better job today than we did 50 years ago, but it's not nearly good enough. So what's to say that if we make a colony on the moon or make a colony on Mars, that we don't mess things up there just as badly as we have here? So we're in control of our future, right? We have to take care of our home. We have to make sure that we can get along and take care of the resources that we have, whether they're on Mars, the moon, or the Earth. So we got some house cleaning and housekeeping to do, and that's part of the maturing, I think, of our species. We've got to learn to do a better job. And if we could spend a small portion of what we spend today figuring out how to throw bigger rocks at each other and focus that on how to, you know, build a brighter future, we could easily do that if we woke up tomorrow morning and decided to do that.
Well, and if you want to see some of Elon Musk's presentations about the rocket, also his plans to terraform Mars, and as he puts it, make it a nice place to live, we've got that on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're covering the latest news in space science with our crew of New Hampshire-based astronomers. We're looking at headlines including the discovery of a kilonova and huge excitement around that in the astronomy community. Also, we've talked about a mission to the moon that the U.S. is planning with the Russians for a lunar orbiting spacecraft. In a moment, we'll talk about increased certainty over a planet 9 in our own solar system and the discovery that Earth has an asteroid buddy. That sounds cozy. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, one more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So here's an email that came in from Bill in Concord. I love Bill's introduction. He says, this may be a bit out there, but I've got to ask because I don't have regular access to physicists. So thank you, Bill. He says, light is energy. If the gravitational wave can cause the laser light to bend, that proves that light has mass, correct? Bill says. So if light has mass and it comes into contact with a gravitational wave, it could change its speed. Doesn't that mean that measuring interstellar distance is imperfect when done by light years, since light could be slowed? Good point, Bill. And if a gravitational wave impacts light in an additive manner, couldn't the speed of light be exceeded? So I think, Nicole, I'm keying in on what he's saying, and he's raising some really good points.
Yeah, so this doesn't necessarily show that light has mass. The light does, however, follow space-time. So there's a complicated or nice little interaction between mass and space-time. I'm waving my hands on the air, which doesn't work in the radio, but we'll try anyway.
Gravitational waves.
You can imagine this grid, which is bent by the presence of mass. You can think of it as a lot of demos we like to do is like a rubber sheet. You put a bowling ball in a rubber sheet, it pulls it down. Now, light is not necessarily affected by the mass itself, but it is following the curve of space-time. So if you ripple that rubber sheet and cause ripples in it like that pond analogy we had earlier, the light is also going to follow that. Doesn't mean light itself has mass. Although you're right, if light had mass, we would see a lot of weird effects that we don't see. So we see light being bent by the presence of really massive things. We call that gravitational lensing. So we do see that already. This is just continuing down that line of light following the curves of space-time.
So does he have a point, and I'll ask anybody, does he have a point that the light could be either speeded up or slowed down by various factors that he mentioned?
Well, I don't know. So the big thing that Nicole said that probably should be even magnified again is that Einstein taught us in the early 1900s that space and time are not separate entities. And Einstein also taught us, right, for the first time, that gravity affects how light travels. So gravity can influence the path of light through space. Now, as far as it retarding light to the point where it makes measurements in space inaccurate, I don't believe so. But we do know and have known for more than 100 years that that light follows the space-time continuum, and that continuum is warped, if you will, by the presence of mass. You know, we all blame Isaac Newton for the universal law of gravity, and he put forth that theory in the 1600s, and or 1700s, sorry, 1700s. And as well as the law of gravity works, and we use it to calculate the trajectories of spacecraft so they can get to their destination planet right at the right time. It works great. But Newton himself did not know and understand how the presence of mass generates gravity. That had to wait until Albert Einstein, who said, well, the reason that gravity works and that mass does cause gravity is that mass bends or warps this space-time continuum. And I know that sounds really sci-fi, but that is in fact what happened and was proved during a total eclipse of the sun in 1919. So it has a lot of observational evidence to lend credibility to the theories of relativity.
Well, and so Bill, it's a great question then, talking about, you know, whether things can be sped up or slowed down. And so forth. So thank you, Bill. And here's a similar one from Amanda on Facebook. And Mal, I'm going to throw this at you. These are tough questions, and I really appreciate them from the audience.
That's all right. I'll make something up.
Amanda says, so the light and gravitational waves from this kilonova both reached us. Here's Amanda's question. Were these in sync, or do the light waves reach first?
Well, put it this way. The gravity waves travel at the speed of light. So they're both, I would say, in sync is probably a good way to do that. Yeah.
This experiment actually helped confirm that gravity waves do move at the speed of light.
But we were slow to detect the radiation. We detected the gravitational waves first and then said, oh my God, let's look for a radiation. So it took us a few days to figure out, okay, who's going to do what? What wavelength? Oh, I can do X-ray, or I can do, infrared. Yeah. So it took us a while to kind of react to that and then find the source.
The field of view of an optical telescope is way smaller than that of a gravitational wave detector, which essentially sees most of the sky at once.
Well, Amanda, thank you for the question. And you too, Bill. The number for you to join us on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So I want to ask all of you about Planet 9, getting a lot closer to home in our own solar system. And John, I'll turn to you first. Scientists said recently they are more and more certain that there is a Planet 9 in our solar system. This after the former ninth planet, Pluto, was demoted about a decade ago. Some people still haven't gotten over that. So what's Planet 9, John, and where might it be?
Well, we love to talk about Pluto. But when it got kicked out of the Planet Club, we were down to 8 classical planets. And this starts an argument every time. So here we go. So the same person, the same scientist in California, Mike Brown, that's his name, the guy that killed Pluto.
So call him, not you.
That's right.
His Twitter handle is literally Pluto Killer.
So he's proud of it. So he has looked at the reason that Pluto lost its status as a planet is because planetary scientists have found a lot of other Pluto-like objects way out there in the outer solar system in a region that we call the Kuiper Belt. So now, instead of Pluto being the only thing out there, like we thought was the case when it was discovered in 1930, now there are hundreds of objects out there, not necessarily right next to Pluto, but in that part of the solar system. So scientists have seen a lot of these, calculated orbit for a lot of these Kuiper Belt objects, and said, it's funny the way these objects are acting, the way they're behaving, the way they're orbiting, the shape of their orbits. And mathematically, if you look at the orbits of these small solar system bodies, it looks like that this influence could be explained by a large, that is, massive object beyond their extent, beyond their distance, that is gravitationally perturbing or, say, bothering their orbits around the sun.
So it's not like they're seeing it,
That's right. So
based on the behavior of other objects in that area, or based on light, or
but indirect detection is a proven scientific method for looking at things that haven't yet been seen observationally. So it's a mathematical pronouncement, and there is increasing evidence as we look at these small bodies more and more. It looks like they're being influenced, but as yet, no smoking gun, no Planet 9, no mystery planet, no Planet X has been seen yet. Of course, that will be a big discovery, but hasn't happened yet.
Well, hopefully it'll happen before we have our astronomers back on, because that would be really fun to talk about. But I'd love to get your thoughts too, Mal, and yours, Nicole. I mean, Mal, to you, what's the significance if Planet 9 is there? I mean, as John described, there's a lot of stuff out there, and, some of it's sort of dwarf planets or they've got all these different names for these smaller, less than planetary bodies. So, if Planet 9 is there, who cares?
Well, the astronomers certainly do, because we've added to the mix of the solar system. If it does exist, it has not been discovered as yet. But the method that they're using to infer that something is there is very similar to what they did when they discovered Neptune. They were seeing perturbations or variations in the way Uranus was orbiting and said there's something tugging or affecting it somewhere out there as well. And when they narrowed down where they thought that might be, they were able to use the telescope and they discovered Neptune. In this case, this is the speculation is that it's or let me back up. If you go to these Kuiper Belt objects, the reason that they're so different from anything else where Pluto is also part of the same thing. The orbital paths that they follow do not line up with the orbital paths of the planets all the way out through Neptune.
Right.
So they're all tilted. Some of them are straight up and down. They're all over the place out there. And there's a group of them that are all kind of going in the same direction together. There's about maybe half a dozen or so. And that was what got our friend, our other, sorry, what was the name again, Mike?
Mike Brown.
Mike Brown, right.
A.K.A. And Pluto
Mike
Killer.
Brown.
A.K.A.
Yeah, Pluto Killer.
The Pluto Killer. But but he's the one that using that same idea that if it is there, it's probably about 20 times further from the sun than Neptune and maybe 10 times the mass of the Earth.
Wow,
so
big.
The speculation. It's a very big one.
And very, very big and very far. So, Nicole, for you, NASA has been asking for the public's help in finding Planet Nine and other planets. And by the way, if you want to look at this citizen science project that NASA has going, you can go to our website again, nhpr.org/exchange. How unusual is this, Nicole, for NASA to ask regular people to come join the search? You might even find a rogue world.
It's becoming more and more common. There's a lot of data in astronomy, lots of images. And although you can program a computer program to search for anomalies, things like planets crossing in front of their parent stars, these exoplanets that we've seen around other stars, there are still a lot of things that work best visually, that takes a human eye brain system to do the pattern matching, to see these things really well. So Planet Hunters is one of these projects that is looking for these exoplanets, and they clean up the data and present it in a nice way on the web so that anyone can come and look at this data and help find these discoveries. So I've assigned this to my students in class. They'll go through a few just to look at it. I used to work for a project called CosmoQuest, which lets you identify craters on the moon and Mars and asteroid Vesta and a bunch of different places, again, because the computers only do so well. So we're getting
that rather
people.
Heartening, actually.
Yeah, we're getting people.
We still need eyeballs and brains.
We still need eyeballs and brains, and we need your eyeballs and brains. I mean, I've actually interviewed a bunch of our citizen scientists. They come from all walks of life, just with an interest and passion in astronomy. To be able to contribute some small way to the scientific research is really important.
So space is so big, and there's so much there that, you know, all the scientists at NASA and at, you know, universities and so forth, they can't do it on their own. They still need the public to get involved.
Still need help. It gets done faster, and it gets done just as accurately, some studies have shown, as if you have experts. If you have an expert sitting there doing it for hours at a time, or if you pull in 10 volunteers to look at an image, they can get through that same thing with same accuracy in much less time.
So I can attest to Planet Killers that Nicole mentioned. My wife is a fifth grade teacher, and she actually had a fifth grader participate in Planet Hunters and analyze data from the Kepler spacecraft looking for exoplanets, only 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And Planet Hunters has people of all ages and walks of life looking at Kepler data, and they could actually be a co-discoverer of a planet orbiting another star.
Very cool. Let's take one more call. This is Steve on Plum Island. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering about the neutron star pair again. I understand that, you know, many stars are binary systems, but I'm trying to fathom how you could have two neutron stars orbiting one another. I would think that whatever events lead to the formation of the first neutron star would severely disrupt the presence of the binary partner when that happened. So how do you end up with two?
Yeah, it's a good question. Seems like an odd coincidence out there in this vast area that we call space.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Steve. And in order for a neutron star to become a neutron star, it has to be involved in a supernova explosion, which is a very disruptive event. And the leftovers from that explosion resulted in a neutron star in this particular case orbiting close together, and that orbit just dwindled over time. So there's lots of this. It's a rare occurrence. That's why we don't see it every day.
Well, so all of you just have about a minute left. And I did want to know, Matt, I'll start with you. What are you going to be watching for in the next couple weeks, either major discoveries or just cool stuff to see in the autumn night sky?
Well, I'm a fan of the winter sky. When I see Orion come up, then there's a lot to look at there in the Orion Nebula down by the belt of Orion. And also, it's a good jumping off point for some great astronomy, just looking at the constellations out there. My favorite would be the Pleiades, for example, that come up, even though I don't like the cold weather that comes with it.
That's why people are more familiar with the summer night sky right. than the winter night sky. So bundle up, put on a sleeping bag, and get out there. How about you, Nicole?
I'm actually still watching the situation in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. The Arecibo Radio Observatory was hit by that along with a lot of the island. So I have a couple of friends down there I've been keeping in contact with. They're doing well. Just kind of keeping an eye on things there. I know the observatory is partially up and running. They're also distributing water and supplies to the local community. So keeping an eye on things in Puerto Rico and seeing where we can donate money and things.
I hadn't even thought about that there might be an important observatory there that had some trouble. John, how about you?
The November the 17th Leonid meteor shower is the next meteor shower. We had the Orionids last weekend, and I have a lot of students that saw many meteors over the weekend. The Leonids originating in the constellation Leo after midnight around the 16th, 17th, and 18th of November. Pray for clear weather.
Okay. John, thank you so much. Good to see you.
My pleasure.
Mal Cameron, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Laura.
And Nicole, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.